The voting is over, but the disinformation machine is humming right along. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Tech. I'm Molly Wood. Votes in the presidential election are, of course, still being counted. The legal challenges have started, and the disinformation efforts that have defined 2020 are still ongoing. For example, there are no credible accounts of ballots suspiciously going missing or turning up or being destroyed, but influencers on lots of social media networks were spreading false narratives about just that on Election Day and beyond. Renee DiResta is the technical research manager at the Stanford Internet Observatory and part of the Election Integrity Partnership, which tracked mis- and disinformation efforts in real time this week. For the most part, she told me the big platforms, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube did all right, but there will always be work to be done.
I've never thought of mis- and disinformation as a problem that we're going to be able to solve, more of a chronic condition that we're going to learn how to manage. And some of that is going to be people developing better media literacy and not believing what they see online quite so credulously as they perhaps did in the past. But also the work that we did as a consortium of institutions, we built a system of tickets where if an instance of misinformation related to voting appeared anywhere in the U.S., in English, in Spanish, and Chinese, we had the ability to do a rapid response assessment, try to understand what was happening, if it was going viral, if it was hopping from platform to platform, and then how we should assess it and who was best positioned to respond to it.
That seems like good news. Although it also sounds like one of the key things that you saw in this election were repeat offenders, right? Often verified influencers spreading misinformation. How did platforms handle those accounts?
So that, I think, is an area that can stand to be improved. Those accounts would receive repeated labels. So rather than really actioning with anything that was a deterrent from future behavior, they would just kind of get a new label with the next offense. So that's something I think that platforms are likely going to be evaluating what happens when there are these chronic offenders. For the most part, I think social media platforms were extremely proactive because nobody wanted to see viral misinformation negatively impact the belief in the legitimacy of the election and the trust in the process.
What about YouTube, which, you know, people paid attention to, of course, the labels on Twitter and Facebook. YouTube sort of skirts some of this conversation. And in your postmortem, basically, you found that live stream channels on YouTube were a vector.
Yes, live stream is very, very difficult to get attention to in the time in which it is happening. So that's a significant challenge. Oftentimes, live streamers have some sort of influence with their audience already. And so one of the things that we saw was, you know, gaming accounts that are not normally focused on politics, but have a large audience using their stream to kind of repurpose old footage, alleging that that things that had happened in the past were happening right then. And you can tell as you look at the comments that people really do believe when this happens that they're seeing something that is in fact live. So I think the challenge of how to address lives that are not really live is something that's out there. It was something that we observed with the Floyd protests also, where live streamers, you know, fake live streamers were posting to Facebook Live insinuating that protests that were happening in certain parts of the country, you know, were violent when in reality they were showing violent footage from past events. So that is a really significant challenge. I think YouTube took down a couple of the streams so that they couldn't survive after the fact as content to be shared. But in the moment, that's a significant area where misinformation can reach a large number of people who often trust the streamer.
And then speaking of narratives, what do you expect to emerge over the next few days and even weeks? And what are the best ways to combat those narratives in advance?
Well, I think for as long as the election remains unresolved, we're going to continue to see narratives move in line with where the contested state of the day is. And then the other thing that we're really seeing already that we'll be talking about quite a bit, I think, in the next few days, is the reemergence of misinformation incidents and delegitimization themes that refer to earlier allegations. So areas where the groundwork had already been laid months in advance, insinuating that if a state didn't go for a particular candidate, usually President Trump, that meant that the result was somehow had been stolen. There had been some sort of conspiracy afoot. And so those narratives began to reemerge. And again, you heard the president himself say in his speech that he felt that the election was being stolen from him.
Do you have sort of a few narratives that you know are likely to come up that people should, people being me, journalists, but also just everyone on Twitter and Facebook, like what should we watch for and go, we already know this is not true?
I think for journalists, it's really important to just immediately, when there is something that is not true, to kind of intercede. There were networks who carried President Trump's speech and didn't immediately kind of quite clearly articulate that the claims that were made in the speech were false. I think that that's going to be a role that journalists are going to have to play going forward, particularly local journalists in swing states who are going to find themselves seeing narratives that had been already addressed kind of, you know, come back from the dead. We're seeing claims that have already been fact-checked. The fact-checked already exists, you know, somewhere either a local journalist did it or one of the social media platform's fact-checking partners went through it. But we're seeing them pop back up again, stripped of the context of the fact-check, just again trying to, as the world is paying attention, as residents of that state are paying attention, trying to make it trend again, trying to delegitimize the direction that that a particular state is trending. So I think that is a really key area that journalists have a major role to play in saying, nope, you know, this already came up and this has already been addressed and here is the truth, and, you know, move back to focusing on what is demonstrably true and what the current state of events actually is.
And then just sort of broadly speaking, people who are very online, let's say, have an awareness that disinformation exists and is part of the landscape. But I wonder how widespread that awareness really is. Like, do you have a sense of whether people know, understand, and accept that disinformation is now just part of the game and you have to be on the lookout for it?
I think that there has been a lot of coverage, particularly from the media over the last 4 years, related to foreign interference. And almost now to the point where the coverage is sort of disproportionate to the actual threat. Meaning, there are always going to be foreign state actors that are going to be interfering in the, you know, in the domestic discourse and, you know, running bots and sock puppet accounts and so on and so forth. I don't see that stopping anytime soon. But the real significant narratives don't emerge from those tiny, relatively tiny operations. They're instead emerging from domestic influencers. And I think that, you know, re-emphasizing that kind of critical thinking, the realization that just because, you know, you may like someone or trust them doesn't mean that they get everything right 100% of the time. Really the need to understand that content goes viral because people feel compelled to share it because they have an emotional response to it. And then oftentimes they haven't actually read the article. Maybe the article takes a much more nuanced stance than the headline did. I think that there's a lot for us to adapt to with regard to the kind of, you know, social media as one more channel in the broader information ecosystem in terms of how we receive and you know, act as sharers ourselves at this point.
Renee D'Aresta is the technical research manager at the Stanford Internet Observatory. And now for some related links. We've got a link at marketplacetech.org to a New York Times piece with more on how the platforms fared. It includes some of the comments from Stanford's post-election debrief and other disinformation watchdogs who still feel the platforms could do more. I'll admit it was a little disturbing to watch Facebook basically work out its labeling policies in real time, first saying it would label any posts that seemed to declare that counting was over or declaring victory in the election, then saying it would not label posts where a candidate declared victory in a specific state, which observers pointed out was not helpful in an election where it looked likely for a while that one specific state could decide the whole thing. And then on Wednesday, Facebook put out guidance saying it would continue to label posts that declared victory or that counting had ended, whether they related to a single state or the entire country. But again, this is the platforms dealing with things fairly well. Anyway, stay alert, keep your eyes peeled, think before you tweet, and go take a nap or a walk or something, friends, because this is stressful. I'm Molly Wood, and that's Marketplace Tech. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.